On this episode of the End of Tourism podcast.
The forest and the land more generally is everything to them, or was everything to them. So it's not only the place where they get food, it's also the whole basis of their identity and their way of life. So once they lose that, they end up in our world, the capitalist system, but at the lowest possible level. So that's why they end up in poverty. But it's a problem that was created by the conservationists themselves. And even when you read their position about trying to improve the situation for the Batwa, it's always about generating revenue, lifting them out of poverty, developing alternative livelihoods. But what we are campaigning for is not some alternative to the loss of their rights, it's their land rights themselves.
Welcome to the End of Tourism, conversations on wanderlust, exile, and radical hospitality. A quick reminder that the podcast lives on a gift economy model, which means that anyone, anywhere can listen, regardless of their economic situation. Your gift ensures it stays that way, free of advertisements and members-only paywalls. It allows me to devote a great deal of time to this project, to pay for the software and hardware that makes the podcast possible, as well as all of the production and post-production labor. In order to keep the project fed, you can subscribe by making monthly, annual, or one-time offerings at chrischristou.substack.com, where you'll also have access to my writing on these and other subjects, including food culture, psychedelics, media ecology, and myth. You can also support us by leaving a review for the pod on Apple or Spotify, by sharing the episodes with your friends, and by following us on social media via the handle The End of Tourism. My guests on this episode are Linda Pope and Martin Lena. Linda is a political scientist and director of the Berlin Office of Survival International, the global movement for indigenous people's rights. She is also part of Survival's campaign to decolonize conservation, which supports indigenous peoples who continue to suffer land theft and human rights abuses in the name of conservation. Martin, meanwhile, is an advocacy officer for Survival International. He primarily works on Survival's campaign to decolonize conservation and has collected testimonies directly from communities facing violations of their rights in the name of conservation. Welcome to the End of Tourism podcast, Martin and Linda. I'd love it if I could start by asking you two to explain to our listeners where you two find yourselves today and what the world looks like there for you.
Well, hi, everyone. My name is Linda. I work for Survival International and I'm in Berlin. I'm at home, actually, and I look forward to talking to you and chatting with you. It's dark outside already, but that's, I guess, the time of the year.
And I'm based in Paris, also at home, but I work at a French office. And how does the world feel right now? It feels a bit too warm for October, but other than that.
Well, thank you both for joining me today. I'd like to begin by reminiscing on the season 3 interview that I had with your colleague Fiore Longo, entitled Decolonizing Conservation in Africa and Beyond. And in that interview, we discussed the history of conservation as colonization in the context of Tanzania and the national parks that were built there and the indigenous lands that were stolen in order to do so. I'm curious if you two could offer a bit of background for our listeners in terms of the history of conservation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and especially in regards to the Batwa people and the Kahuzi Biega National Park.
We were quite, you know, astonished of the colonial history that we find in the park where we're here to discuss today. Well, the Congo, obviously, you know, was a colony. And I think in this context, we also need to look at the conservation that is happening in the DRC today. And a lot of the things that you have discussed with our colleague Fiola are very true for the DRC as well. And the park that we're going to look at today, I think it's probably also the best example to start to explain a little bit what conservation looks like in DRC. It's an older park, so it was created a longer time ago, and it was always regarded as something that is there to protect precious nature for people to look at and not for people to go and live in. And this is exactly what the problem is today, which we see continue, is that the people that used to live on this land are being pushed outside violently, separated from the land which they call home, which is everything for them, the supermarket, the church, the school, just in the name of conserving supposed nature. And unfortunately, this is something that we see all over the DRC and different protected areas that exist there, that we still follow this colonial idea of mostly European conservationists in history and also current that claim that they're protecting nature, often in tandem with international conservation NGOs. And the park we look at today, it's the Wildlife Conservation Society. And they're, yeah, trying to get rid of the original inhabitants that have guarded these spaces for such a long time.
To build on that, in our campaign to decolonize conservation at Survival, we often say that fortress conservation has deep colonial roots, and you can definitely see that with the actual history of the Kahuzi-Biega National Park, because it started as a reserve that was created by the Belgian colonial government in 1937, and it was transformed into a national park after independence, so in the 70s. But it was still designated as such following the lobbying of a Belgian conservationist. So it's really the continuation, the Western and the European will to keep controlling the independent territories. And that in Africa oftentimes was done through conservation.
And it also has this idea of, like, I think a lot of the conservation projects that we see, Martin just said it, there was also this post-independence push on creating national parks, which was obviously related to the idea that Europeans might lose hold of control in certain areas. So they were pushing for the creation of national parks like the Kahuzi-Biega National Park. And that is the setting that we're talking about, basically, something that has very colonial roots and has been pushed into the post-colonial era, but in a way which is actually very colonial.
Thank you both for that brief history and introduction into what we'll be speaking about today. Linda, you mentioned that so many of the circumstances around the creation of these national parks includes the exclusion and displacement of the original inhabitants. And in this case, among others, this includes the Batwa people. And so I'd like to just give our listeners a little bit of a context for what's happened to the Batwa in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so the statistics tell us that over 90% of the 87,000 indigenous Batwa people in the park have lost legal access to their native territory, turned into conservation areas, and who are desperately poor, according to a 2009 United Nations report. Now, in a recent Reuters article, it's written that, quote, local human rights and environmental experts say that the authorities' failure to fulfill promises to the Batwa has undermined efforts to protect the forest and its endangered species, including some of the last populations of eastern lowland gorilla. Some of the Batwa around the park participate in the illegal poaching, mining, and logging that are destroying the gorilla's globally significant habitat. As a result, the conservation outlook for the park is critical, according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The article goes further and says that the Batwa have no choice because they are poverty-stricken, according to Josue Aruna, president of the province's Environmental Civil Society Group, who does community outreach with the Batwa. It seems in this way that the land rights and traditional lifestyles of the Batwa are intimately tied to the health and survival of the ecosystems within the national park, which they've been excluded from, and that their poverty is a consequence of their displacement. Do you think that the issue is as simple as that?
It's always interesting to read these reports from the conservationists, whether it's the IUCN or the NGOs, because the problem is always the local people. So they are poor and they have no choice. They participate in poaching. And it's always their fault. Like you were saying, if they end up being poor, it's because they were evicted from the land. And as Linda was saying earlier, the forest and the land more generally is everything to them, or was everything to them. So it's not only the place where they get food, it's also the whole basis of their identity and their way of life. So once they lose that, they end up in our world, capitalist system, but at the lowest possible level. So that's why they end up in poverty. But it's a problem that was created by the conservationists themselves. And even when you read their discourse or their position about trying to improve the situation for the Batwa, it's always about generating revenue, lifting them out of poverty, developing alternative livelihoods. But what we are campaigning for is not some alternative to the loss of their rights. It's their land rights themselves. And to go to your other question about the fact that the loss of their land rights has led to a degrading in the health of the ecosystem, I think, yes, for sure, that has been the case. And it's what we are seeing all around the world in these protected areas that are supposed to protect nature. But actually, once you evict the best conservationists and the people that were taking care of the land for decades, then there is room for all kinds of exploitation, whether it be mass tourism or luxury safaris or even mining and logging concessions. So it's not a coincidence if 80% of the biodiversity on the planet is located in indigenous territories. It's because they have lived in the land. It's not wild nature. They have lived there for generations. They have protected it and they have shaped it through their practices. So to us, the best way to protect these ecosystems is to ensure that their land rights are respected, and blaming them for poaching or putting that on the fact that they are poor, it's just dishonest and ignoring the basis of the problem.
Yeah, I agree. And when you just read out these sentences, I noted down like the way it was formulated, as a result, the park is threatened. It's again, just focusing on the local people as being the problem. Like the protected area is there to protect an area from the local people, which I think becomes very clear in the way you explained it. And also, like Mata, I'm quite struck by the idea that they talk about poor people, but ignoring that, you know, their actions that of the Batwa have also caused this poverty. So it's, in a way, you know, first you make people poor and then you kind of insult them almost for being poor and then, you know, acting accordingly. I think that is quite, you know, ignoring what has happened. And I think it's the same with the general model of conservation. Like the sentences you read, I mean, there is some sympathy in it, you know, it sounds like, oh, these poor people, you know, in a way we regret what has happened and that they were evicted. But it's like those poor people, they don't really look at, you know, why were they evicted and what are the consequences for our kind of conservation today? Like the consequence could that the Batwa can return to their land because they are the best guardians and because it would give them a base to live, not in poverty. So that consequence they don't see. It's because they ignore all the things that have caused the supposed poverty and have caused this kind of conservation that we see. So don't think about what we've done in the past. We'll just go on, but that is a problem because they don't learn any lessons from what has happened and that land rights should be so important.
Yeah, I think that definitely points towards this notion that I think a lot of people are becoming apt to in our times and these days, which is the general kind of approach to the dilemmas in these contexts are to look at the symptoms of the dilemma and not the causes. And in the context of the eviction and exile, displacement of the Batwa people, one of the articles mentions that one of the consequences of the induced poverty includes the endangering and further endangering of the eastern lowland gorilla. And I mention this because in my research leading up to this interview, this conversation, I looked into the tourism offerings in Kahuzi Biega in the national park, and I found the following. I'm just going to read off the list of what I did find. Gorilla safaris or trekking, chimpanzee rehabilitation center tours, camping safaris, cultural tours, bird watching, hiking, climbing, and boat cruises. And so my next question is this. To what extent does the safari tourism in the national park play a part in this conflict?
Well, that's a super interesting question. I mean, that obviously depends on the specific park that you look at. But I think I would say in almost any national park that we look at its survival, there is some kind of idea that this park needs to have tourists. Tourists need to come and go and see the beauty of nature, ideally Western tourists, so that they become involved in conservation and donate money. And also in a way that tourism would be a way to pay for services that are related to maintaining the park. So it's something that usually always pops up. It's kind of like twins a little bit. And, you know, I work on mostly German politics and how they relate to this conservation. And it's something that you can't really separate. Where you read about conservation projects that the German government funds, you will always also read about tourism. So they're very interlinked. In some parks, you know, there isn't a lot of tourism because the situation is not very attractive to Western tourists. But the idea is always there. And then the extent to which tourism actually happens obviously differs and then has different effects. In some parks that we work on, there's a lot of tourism. There's a lot of creation of infrastructure for tourists, hotels, for roads for tourist vehicles to go places. Then it obviously has a much stronger impact on the area and also on the people that live there. If there are less tourists, then the actual effect of tourism is, of course, a little bit less than it might sound in these proposals to have tourists there at all.
In the context of conflict zones, which, from what I understand, this particular park in the Congo is a conflict zone, or at least parts of it, that tourism can act as a kind of barrier between local populations or local ecologies and the consequences of those conflict zones, right? But it doesn't necessarily stop the conflict. It just turns it underground. It turns a kind of blind eye to it, waiting. In most instances that I know of, until the organized crime in the area ends up getting, you know, their hands into the economy of the tourism itself.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Linda that it's always there and it's always under the discourse and it's never only about conservation. There's always tourism. And often the national parks are created for this purpose. If you read the UNESCO definition or the IUCN definition of what a national park is, it says it's also for recreation. So these places are built for tourists against the locals. So yeah, it's always there and it's even in the definition. So
yeah, when you said tourism as a barrier, in some cases, tourism can amplify the problems that are there because there's more eviction or there's more interest of, for example, governments to evict people to create this great picture of nature, which is so attractive to tourists. So I think I will find it as something that can really worsen the situation. I think from what I've seen, you know, we sometimes talk about sustainable tourism or respectful tourism, but in the terms of conservation projects, my impression really is that it's been harmful. And the indigenous populations that work in tourism, which is one of the things that funders of conservation projects often say, that they can find jobs in tourism. A lot of these jobs are not very good. And I would argue that a lot of times people need to take these jobs because they have lost the choice to not take a job and live from the forest.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to wonder about in the little research that I did around what's happening in this particular park in the Congo, that there are rebel groups. It is a conflict zone. And yet there are these tourism offerings, right? And that surely the champions of the national park and conservation in many areas would say, well, you know, the more tourism we can get in here, the more we can undermine at least the economic causes, if not the political ones that are contributing to the violence. When in fact, from what I can understand from survival's work, it's just deepens the causes that produced that conflict and that exile in the first place.
Yeah. And I think there's also perception of injustice, which we shouldn't underestimate. I mean, if you're an indigenous person that has been violently evicted or whose family has been violently evicted from a certain area, and then you see Western tourists mostly, which are rich, you know, pay a lot of money for these trips, are allowed to go in and use that area in a way. I think that also creates, yeah, a sense of injustice, which also, yeah, it's quite sad.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And then that's certainly what we see in over-touristed places around the world and in places that are just starting to become over-touristed, this kind of deep resentment amongst locals for the inequalities, the growing inequalities, and yeah, as well, the injustices that these industries bring. And so on that point of conflict zones, especially in and around Cahuzi Biega, I wanted to ask you both a question around the militarization of conservation. So some people believe that militarized park police, which is what exists in this park, are a necessary evil. Officially, at least, the guards protect the park from armed militias or rebel groups in the area, ensuring that they stay out of the park. Of course, those who they confront and sometimes attack also include the indigenous people, the Batwa in this case, who are trying to retake and reclaim their ancestral lands. And the argument is that without the guards, the land would fall into the hands of much more malevolent groups or forces. And so how do you think the presence of armed conflict as well as militarized conservation guards complicates the issue?
That's a tough question. Well, maybe I can just give like a little anecdote. It was actually about this park, the Cahuzi Biega National Park, and we were talking to German politicians and government officials about the problem of conflict and about the problem that these park rangers, you know, are trained and have a lot of weapons, which seems very militant. And they were seeing the problem. They were seeing that this is probably not the best thing they should do, support security forces in an area which is already so problematic. But their thinking was, if we don't give them the money, you know, we have created this force, basically. We have hired people, we have trained them. Now, if we stop supporting them, what are they going to do? You know, they're going to maybe take their training and their weapons and make it even worse. So in a way, I mean, this was off record, right? They were just kind of thinking out loud. But in a way, they were seeing that the project that they have supported have created structures which very likely will increase conflict. And it seems quite obvious also because you see all these conflicts with indigenous peoples. So I'm not going to say that it's a very peaceful area and there is not a need maybe for people to defend themselves. But in a way, the structures that we have in militarized conservation are not the solution. You know, they make the situation much more complicated than it initially was. And now, like in this park, we're in a situation where we witness terrible human rights abuses and everyone is scared to act and do something because it could get even worse. And it's, yeah, it doesn't seem like a very good solution. I think we need another way. We can't just stick our head. Let's say, oh, you know, we just go on and then let someone else deal with it in a few years. I don't think that's a very good example. Mm.
And it's questionable also to what extent do these guards, these armed rangers actually protect the parks and the species, because they are here supposedly to fight against illegal wildlife trade and poaching and everything. But what studies have shown is that the root cause of poaching and of the illegal wildlife trade is mostly the demand for such products that comes from industrialized countries or at least other parts of the world. And the system is made for the guards to take action against the local population and not against the actual criminal networks that lead to illegal wildlife trade and poaching. They get money for people they arrest, and the easiest people to find are the locals that are trying to get to their ancestral lands. And there's also sometimes the park management involved in these criminal networks. So you pretend to put in place a system to fight against illegal wildlife trade, but there ends up being no choice but for the guards to take on the local people.
Maybe we should also think about the indigenous populations as guards, or maybe guardians is the better word, of this area. And we zoom out of the DRC and look at South America, where we have much stronger land rights. Not perfect, of course, better for indigenous peoples. They often act as guardians or guards of these territories, even though they're also confronted with illegal logging, quite brutal illegal logging, for example. But in a way, they are there, and they, of course, are supported by authorities, ideally, in defending these territories. But you see a less violent or militarized conflict because you have the indigenous guardians, as opposed to starting out with protected areas and armed guards, which are not just there to defend themselves, but have extensive rights of use of violence. And they don't have to fear any repercussions if something goes wrong and they kill, for example, an indigenous person. I mean, that's what we've seen in this park, that they can basically act with impunity.
And thank you, Linda, for offering that example of the difference or the contrast between places like the Cahuzi Biega National Park in the DRC and other places in South America, for example, where there is this inherited intergenerational understanding of guardianship. And while there's only maybe a half a century of conservation industry in these places, of course, they're an extension of the colonial project or projects that were undertaken much further back in time in places like Africa and places like the DRC before it was known as such. And then what happens, you know, after X amount of generations, after this kind of exile and displacement, that there is no lived memory anymore of what it means to be a guardian of your place. And I don't just mean as a title, but in terms of how you guard that place as an indigenous person. We might be able to say that the Western world or the modern world, that that's very much what we've become, is people who are unable to remember or have a lived memory of what it's like to adequately stand as guardians for a place. But, you know, I think with the work that you two and Survival International are doing, that there's a path forward towards that. And I'd like to remind our listeners that we're also here speaking today in part because there was a victory that was won by Survival International on behalf of the Batwa people and activists like yourself. And so I'd like to just read very briefly from a July 2023 press release from Survival International, in which it is said that, quote, in a landmark decision, the French government has scrapped its plan to fund the controversial Cahuzi Biega National Park in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. France's Minister of State for Development, Francophonie and International Partnerships, Chrysoulou Zakharopoulou, confirmed that the plan to begin financing the Cahuzi Biega National Park has been scrapped. Zakharopoulou said, quote, it has been abandoned in line with our requirement for the respect of human rights. So first of all, I'd like to say congratulations to you both and to your teams at Survival for getting this victory and for doing the work you need to do in order to get there. And I'd like to ask about the strategies that were employed in order to revoke French support for the park. You know, so many of these efforts and victories are either ignored in the context of the endless dilemmas, or they're celebrated kind of superficially without considering the work it took to organize such campaigns. And so my question is, how has this campaign been organized by Survival International?
Well, to give a bit of context, the first time we heard about the French Development Agency planning on funding Cahuzi Biega, it was in the exact same time period as the publication of a report by Minority Rights Group International detailing brutal waves of violence in until 2020 of appalling human rights abuses. So atrocities that including murder, torture, rape, the burning alive of children, the burning of villages, So we're in this context where we're reading the Minority Rights Group report and understanding the scale of these waves of violence against the Batwa. And around the same period, we see that the French Development Agency has been a delegation, including the director, has been to the park and plans on sending it. So, of course, we are appalled and decide to write to the French Development Agency, but also to the ministry that has oversight. So one of them is the Ministry for Foreign Affairs. And then we wait. And then we also got the support of a senator who also sent a letter and asked a question in parliament to the government about their plan to fund this park in the context of these human rights violations. And so in July 2022, so last year, they decided to suspend temporarily the project. It was also in the context of an internal scandal because there was an expert in the field and contracted by the French Development Agency to carry out a feasibility study. And he was basically saying around, and it can be heard in recordings, saying that basically the study is just a formality and that the decision to fund the park has already been made. Mm. So there's both scandals, an internal scandal about the due diligence apparently being considered a formality on the field, and the scandal of the very detailed report that had just gone out about the atrocities. So that led to a temporary suspension, and they said that they would conclude the study and look into the abuses and the social aspects. And then a year passed, and we kept sending letters, of course, and doing some public campaigning about it on social media, etc. And then the senator asked again a question in July this year, and that's when we learned that the project was cancelled. So, of course, it's a victory, and it shows that sometimes the government actually does have the oversight on the development agencies and takes the right decisions. But of course, it's just the whole model still needs to be challenged, and the park still has many international backers, even in the context of the atrocities that we know about.
Mm. So the senator that asked about the status of the funding and found out that it was in fact scrapped, the scrapping of the funding was never made public until that point, or there was never any press release saying so?
No, they made it public in the answer to the question, orally, in commission, in parliament.
And would there be no way that the French public, for example, would be able to find out about this otherwise?
I don't think so. And to be honest, I'm not even sure the decision had been taken before. I think they looked into it again because the senator asked a question again, but that's just speculation.
And you spoke about writing letters, obviously, to politicians and to the ministries and also social media campaigns. Do you think there was more of an effect on the scrapping of the funding because of the public campaign, the social media campaign?
Yeah, I think, and that's basically the whole premise on which our campaigns are based, is that an efficient mobilization of the public opinion will lead, and the fact that the public cares and is informed will lead to a more efficient lobbying and advocacy of the governments and other government agencies. So, yeah, I think one can't go without the other. And I don't know what would have happened if only the senator had asked the questions, or if only the senator had asked a question, or if we had only sent a letter and no public campaigning at all, or no press release, or no social media. I don't know. So I think, yeah, both go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that without the report from the minority rights group, that the funding would have gone ahead regardless of what was actually happening there?
It's possible, because we know that the funders were aware for years and years of the human rights violations. And even before the waves of violence that are described in the report, we know that they were aware of that risk of violence at that time and of the human rights violation in the whole context of the militarized park. So I think it could have very well gone ahead because the other funders knew and kept funding it. And yeah, it's very important to get that kind of report with very detailed testimonies and information from the ground and really documenting these atrocities. Otherwise, it's just business as usual.
Right. And the original proposal for the funding, at least by the French government or the ministries involved, they were basically just promoting conservation in the way that it typically is. That's what the funding was for?
Well, it's hard to know because they never published anything, and actually they never actually started funding it. It was just a project. Like I said, they went on a visit there and started making promise to the local conservation agencies and to the local authorities. But it's not clear to this day what exactly they were planning on funding, but it was clearly stated that they were planning on supporting the park itself, but I don't know for which kind of activities, but still funding the same structure that has been responsible for these abuses is still unacceptable.
Sounds sketchy, as we say in English. And so for our listeners, just a little bit of further context, while France simply abandoned plans the country had not yet made, or the government had not yet made, Germany continues to finance the park, despite France's, however, subtle acknowledgement of human rights violations. And so, Linda, my question for you is, first of all, why is Germany funding a national park in the DRC to begin with? And if you know, how does that money get spent?
Well, I guess the German interest in this park is pretty old. So the German government started funding the park already in the 80s. And there were some other projects even before that, supposedly. But it's considered to be a very, well, it obviously is a very long-running project financed by the German government. And some local people call it the German park because they assume that without the German funding, it wouldn't even exist. Like the kind of money that has been given over decades and the kind of things that have been funded, the infrastructure, the Congolese conservation authorities, the park rangers, you know, all the things that were funded, basically crucial for the park to function. So, yeah, it is a very German-funded project. And also the German government has for a very long time looked at it as being a prestigious project. You know, it was this great park, the gorillas, you already mentioned it, you know, and the Germans been funding it, which when you know a bit about German history, post-World War II, there was a lot of interest in biodiversity and conservation funding because it was a good thing to do, which gave Germany a little bit of a different international picture than it had after the war. So there was a lot of interest in funding projects, and they were perceived as being fantastic, and they were shown to be these great projects that Germany is supporting internationally. And then, obviously, it isn't. But the German government has been very, very good at denying that there are these problems and the role that it has had in facilitating these horrific human rights abuses.
And how, if at all, has the German government responded to the scrapping of the French funding?
Very good timing, because I just got a response today, actually, from the German government, because we did point out to them that the French government has decided to not fund the park because of the violations of indigenous people's rights and because of human rights concerns. So we pointed this out to the ministry again, just in case they would not have learned about this themselves. But the reply basically doesn't address this at all. You know, this was what we wrote the letter about, and the reply is about all the great things that the German government keeps funding and the improvement it is supposedly seeing on the ground, and these improvements justifying their continued support. So it's just a letter explaining why they continue funding it and not addressing why maybe partners like the French government have decided not to fund it. And it's something that we have seen over the years. I think Survival First raised human rights violations in the Kahuzi-Belya National Park in actually 2017. So that's quite a few years ago. There was a Batwa family, a father with his son, the teenage son. They were going into the park to collect herbs for medicine because another son of the family was sick. They encountered park rangers who killed the teenager and wounded the father. So it was quite a terrible incident. And the father wrote to the German government, to the funders, and he complained about these human rights violations and the fact that the Batwa have lost access to the park and to their livelihood because of the German funding. And the German government just said, well, you know, there's not much we can do about it, basically. They tried to pay some money, but then really nothing else happened. And over the years, the situation hasn't improved. It has gone worse. But the German government keeps saying that they have faith in the Congolese conservation authorities and they do not see grounds to stop the funding or the project. And they keep saying that they see progress and things will get better. And we know it hasn't gone better.
But I'd like to return anyways to this question around tactics and strategies and organizing. It seems that activists and those not directly involved in social movements struggle with the weight of our times. I mean, it's, you know, kind of hard to ignore these days. And so given that the German government, I imagine, is the obvious next target in the campaign to defund Kahuzi Biega, or at least the conservation authorities and programs there, what tactics, what strategies are being employed by survival in your campaigns? And how might our listeners in Germany, France, Europe, and beyond, how might they participate?
That's a very good question. Because as I said, you know, survivors have been working on this for a few years and there's a little bit of frustration, of course, that not much is happening in the terms of acknowledging the problem of funding this part. I think what we're thinking is quite important in this issue of conservation is making sure that donors in the West understand that this is a very symptomatic problem. So a lot of conservation projects function like this, and it is because there is this underlying problem with them that they do not acknowledge land rights, but they continue to say that certain government authorities or certain conservation organizations are best put to run these places. It's the same with the Kahuzi Biega National Park. The German government now says, well, you know, there are problems, so we pull in the WCS, the conservation organization, and everything will be better. But it won't, because they also have a record of not respecting indigenous people's rights. So we need to make them understand that there's this underlying issue of not acknowledging indigenous people's land rights. And we try to do this by pointing out that this is a problem which is happening in a lot of national parks. So protected areas that survival has looked at in Africa and Asia, almost all of them, even the ones that we were told were good examples, have these problems. And we tried to show that to the donors that have such big impact on these conservation projects and make them rethink what they're doing. It's a very difficult process, of course, because they've always done it in a different way. And now it's hard for them to think about, you know, giving control and power to local people, which until now they've always said is a threat to conservation. It's like a total turn of what they assumed so far. But for us, it seems like that's the thing that we have to do for them to actually acknowledge the problem, because otherwise all the solutions that they come up with are not real solutions. They put people like the WCS in power, which is also not going to respect the butler's rights.
Yeah, I think one of the critiques around development is in the context of these industries, especially things like conservation, volunteerism is another one, that as industries, you would imagine that they would have in their mission statement or vision or 10-year plan the slow and intentional disappearance of their own industry, right? Because if what they were doing was working, we would need less of them. And there would be less of them. But here we are, right? And it's just, of course, a massively growing industry, both conservation and volunteerism.
Yeah, it's true that our key targets are the donors, because like many of the issues that indigenous peoples are facing across the world, the root of the problem and the funding for these problems come from the West and our societies. So that's going to remain one of our targets and key part of the strategy. I think we are starting to see a shift in the discourse in France, at least. And when we talk to the politicians, we also see that shift in the discourse of the conservation NGOs, but it's still as harmful. So instead of saying that these places are wild and empty and that the local are destroying it or encroaching, Well, they still say it, but they also say that what we were saying before about the poverty issue, and that they will generate new projects and new activities and development, basically. So I think that they are starting to acknowledge the presence of these people. They couldn't be farther from recognizing their land rights, because, like you said, also otherwise it means their own disappearance and they're not built for all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a difficult thing. I mean, I think we try to talk to people that are more inclined to understand the importance of indigenous people's rights, so that we can have a base of people that support our campaigning, which is very important for us. And then we select our targets and try to engage the people that support us in convincing these targets to change projects or change their minds. And sometimes, you know, that can just be a tweet that texts someone who we know makes decisions about certain projects, try to raise awareness that there is concern about this project, that some people disagree, that this doesn't comply with human rights, that this doesn't comply with agreements or treaties they're supporting for indigenous people's rights. And sometimes it's a more complex lobbying strategy. So there are different things we try to do. And sometimes, like we saw with the example of the French government, sometimes it works because there's timing, there's different things coming together. But obviously, even though we have a lot of strategies, it's always difficult to know what will work in the end. So we try different things and try to engage with people that will help us spread the word about the need to decolonize conservation and do it differently and acknowledge land rights. And sometimes it's little things that really change a lot. Sometimes we work on something for a long time and it wasn't the right strategy and we need to change.
Well, speaking of, how might our listeners find out more about Survival International, decolonized conservation campaigns, and especially around the work that you two are doing?
Well, I strongly encourage people to read more of our campaigns on the website, on social media, also to subscribe to our newsletter, because that's where we mostly share our urgent actions, so which are one of our tools to put pressure on the targets. So mass emails basically sent by our supporters to the targets about specific projects. And we also publish some direct video testimonies in our tribal voice projects, as we call it. So if they want to listen to the victims explaining the problems they are facing, but also the way of life that they have lost, or sometimes more inspiring things about the resistance and the fight, I think it's also very interesting to hear directly from the people affected. But yeah, I strongly encourage people to join the movement by any means possible. And sometimes, as Linda said, just small actions like a tweet or sending an email through these campaigns can really make an impact. And it does help ensure that the advocacy and the lobbying is effective.
Yeah, and I think it's also a nice way to picture it, that you're showing solidarity with, for example, the Batwa, who often perceive the Western donors as being the cause of their problem. And I think for them, it's nice to see that there are also people in the countries that where their problems originate that are standing up for their rights and supporting them. And I think it's probably the least we can do, also because we're so obsessed with African nature that I think it would be a very good step for us to think about the people that live in these places.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe not immediately or superficially, in part because of the inundations and the dilemmas in our times. But that kind of solidarity can begin to break down as well the largely like unconscious nationalist tendencies we have when we think of other people in other countries. We always associate those people with their governments, right? Which is just like absolutely ridiculous when anyone thinks of themselves in relation to their own government, right? But these are two faces, two voices of the resistance that are working on behalf of many others. And so I just wanted to reiterate that we're here today just to have the chance to be able to speak about a little bit about this small victory that, all willing, will lead to many more, to much bigger ones in regards to the decolonized conservation campaign of Survival International. It takes work, and I'm grateful to be able to speak with you both today and to have you share some of your work and your dedication with our listeners. And I will make sure that all of those links that you mentioned, Martine, will be on the End of Tourism website and available for our listeners to sign up to the newsletter and follow on social media and, of course, participate if they so wish. So thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Pod. If what you heard had its way with you, if it left you with more questions than answers, then click subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or directly at chrischristou.substack.com. You can also follow us on social media via the handle The End of Tourism. I'd like to especially thank Alexi Galar for his assistance in the post-production process of this episode and many others in this season of The Pod. You can check out his sound design and original music work at alexegalar.com. If you'd like to support The Pod in other ways, we'd love assistance in the form of post-production editing and promotion, or anything else you feel called to offer. Until next time, farewell, friends.